Welcome to A Sporting Discussion, your podcast talking sports of all sorts. After a long lockdown-motivated hiatus, we are back. I'm AJ Mithen, and welcome again, Andrew Donison. Andrew, it's been a while.
We're back, baby!
We're back. How did lockdown 2 treat you?
Oh,
this time it was personal.
I was going to say, yeah, you know how lockdown 1 people baked bread and they learned how to crochet?
Oh, the fun we had, the fun we all had.
Oh, what a jolly good time. Lockdown 2, I survived. I've talked to people and talked about a continuum of existing, surviving, and thriving. And I think that I'm just on the right-hand side, the positive side of surviving. Oh, so I wasn't just existing. I was surviving plus, but I wasn't thriving. How about
surviving
you,
plus,
AJ?
That's good. I've got two kids. I noticed very little difference. particularly with the 5K rule. But I have to, I do tell you one thing, Andrew. It's a shameful thing I do need to say. Lockdown 2 got me. I'm fat.
I've
put on so much weight.
Hey, you know what? No judgment, because whatever you needed to do to get through, you needed to do to get through. Absolutely no judgment.
I hate my feelings. But look, I'm not ashamed to put the call out there. If there's any personal trainers or dietitians listening to this new episode and they want to help out someone who needs a helping hand, get
they
in
want
touch.
A case study.
Get in. Yes, a case study. That's perfect. Get on to us at Twitter at ASD_radio or go to facebook.com/asportingdiscussion or the funky website asportingdiscussion.com.au.
So many ways to get in touch.
Now,
so many ways to get in touch.
We were thinking about how funky we would be on our first show back from lockdown hub life hiatus, and Andrew, we figured it was just time to bash out a good old Q&A. What do you reckon?
Oh, it's the best way to do it, because we could take days to prepare and research and
line up a guest
invested.
Yeah,
but why would we when you can ask me questions, I can ask you questions, we can not know what those questions are, and we can just have a crack at answering them.
That's right. Questions without notice, and a couple thrown in from the crowd as well on the respective Facebook and Twitter accounts I mentioned moments ago. Shall we get into it, Andrew? Do you want
fire
to go
away,
first?
Or
do you
want me
to go? All right, you said fire
no,
away.
No. I'm like the darkness. I believe in a thing called love, and I believe in you.
Oh, thank you. That's sweet. Late November when we record this show, Andrew. Late November 2020.
Yes, it is.
Why are the Women's Big Bash finals being played this week?
So I'm going to suggest two reasons. One, I think it was last year was the first year that they decoupled the Men's and Women's Big Bash. So it might have been 2 years ago. The Women's Big Bash was played prior to the Men's, and it was towards the end of the year. This year, though, it is COVID-related, because they've, much like every other sporting association, probably around the world, but definitely in Australia, they've tried to get everything as compact as possible, and they're also hubbing it up. So a bit of hub life for the WBBL teams. They are all in Sydney, and they're staying at the Olympic Village. There's been some really good footage from the Olympic Village. Some, I believe it's social media activation is what they would call it in the business. And so I think Aaron Burns from the Sydney Sixers is one who has been having a camera follow her around. She's been doing interviews with various people around the hub, both from her team and from others. It's actually been really good. There's been some very good social media content. But the
isn't
reason
it odd,
COVID,
though, that the players will spend the entire summer twiddling their thumbs?
Possibly, but I like to look at it as they have the opportunity to get complete and utter fresh air. There's no other cricket going on. The men's summer commences on Friday, the international men's summer, I should say.
One day is against India.
One day is against India. So tonight, the Melbourne Stars are playing the Perth Scorchers in the first semi-final of the WBBL. It's the first of five matches in a row in Sydney. So a WBBL semi-final tonight, then another one tomorrow night, Sydney Thunder against the Brisbane Heat. Friday night is the Australian men's team against India. Saturday night is the women's WBBL final, and Sunday is another Australia-India. So it's a smorgasbord of cricket. I quite like the fact that it has its own space in the calendar.
Oh, yeah, no one's arguing about its own space. It's just weird that they're getting it out of the way and done before the official summer of cricket commences. They're calling this part of the summer of cricket, but it's November anyway.
Well,
it seems to me that an opportunity is missed for late January, early February for it to be a standalone. Even it's a standalone anyway, so that doesn't matter. Anyway, we've had enough of that one.
Oh, okay, righto, fair enough. That was your question to me.
Now that we're back, now that we're back from Hub Life, I'm being bloody tight on question time and answer time now.
Okay, so be warned. Right. AJ, yes. I've got a question for you.
Ooh.
If you are a professional athlete and you are found to have a banned substance in your system, should the reason why that banned substance got into your system impact on the ban or sanction that you get?
Young me would say no, but old me says yes. There are sometimes there's mitigating circumstances for how something got into your body. If you are able to prove that 100% beyond all doubt that it was either inadvertent or someone spiked your drink or it was there's no reasonable doubt, I guess, in the Court of Arbitration for Sport or the World Anti-Doping Authority's procedures, which is where I guess we're talking about Shayna Jacks here.
Shayna Jack, yeah.
Had her 4-year suspension busted down to 2 because they said even though she had the illegal substance in her body, they didn't think she took it deliberately. Is that right?
Correct, yeah. She did not knowingly ingest the substance.
Pretty gutsy to walk around after that like she was saying, I've been vindicated, I didn't do anything wrong, here you go. Oh, by the way, I can't do anything for another 2 years because I'm suspended for a drug violation, but hey.
So what I quite liked was firstly how she came up with three potential options as to how the drug Ligandrol got into her system, but also then how she just went, yeah, but it was there, so I'm kind of – I accept. Yeah. I accept the 2 years. I didn't want to accept. I didn't like the 4 years. My favourite part though was that she suggested a contaminated blender used by her partner or brothers as a possible source of the positive drugs test.
You know what? That's actually a lot more realistic than some of the excuses we've had. Like, I was in a nightclub and I kissed someone, and that's how I tested positive for cocaine. Or I ate a big steak, and that's how I tested positive for this diuretic. Or all of that. A contaminated blender. I can believe that story.
Yeah, and also I like the fact that she's not hanging on to that. She's saying it could have been that, or it could have been that the supplements were contaminated at manufacturing, or there was another reason supplementary she was taking at manufacturing. Oh yeah, a third one was ingested it as a result of using pool and or gym facilities open to the public.
I don't know about that one. Yes.
No.
Unless someone leaked the drinking fountain after taking it, after having a protein shake. Yes.
So there was, after a couple of, in the AFL, a couple of Collingwood players got done for a banned substance. And one of the reasons why you might have that in your system, it was, as you were saying before, contaminated steak. Now, they didn't say that. They just said, yep, my bad, give us our suspension. But I remember reading at the time that there was a junior soccer tournament, maybe an under-19 World Cup, where an entire team was tested positive for this banned substance.
There's been a couple of boxers as well who have fought over in Eastern Europe. I think the way cattle is I think Lucas Brown, Australian heavyweight, was one of those after he beat
Big Daddy Brown. Chagov. Please,
the way they prepare the cattle and the meat has something in it that is an illegal substance. But hey, it's in your body, you're busted.
Next. Well, no. So the Junior Football World Cup. They went, well, there's too many of you for this to be a coincidence. Yeah, you're okay.
Oh, that's the doping of the future. Just drug the entire team and then go, oh, how did that happen? On to the next one, Andrew.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen.
Andrew, has a 331-game AFL veteran done enough to be classified as a rookie? Obviously, I'm talking about Eddie Betts, who plays for Carlton. Over 300 games, 612 goals. Has what are they saying? Selflessly decided to take a spot on Carlton's rookie list so that they can lodge another player on the real list, so they don't have to make any further changes to their current playing list. He's 35 years old, Andrew. He's on a 1-year deal. 17 years of AFL football. So do you think he's qualified as a rookie?
How many games did you say that he's played?
331.
331. Well, he has 129 more games than fellow rookie Shane Mumford and about 67 more games than fellow rookie Grant Birchall, who both today were also put on their teams' respective rookie lists.
Let's not forget Geelong rookie player Lachie Henderson, who was defending in the grand final. The grand final loss to Richmond. I think we can sense a trend here, Andrew. Is the simple change just to change it to from being called a rookie list, or is there a structural problem that's busted up in the AFL?
All right, so I did have a look at this. 1996 is when the rookie list came out. So in October 1996, it was officially announced, and every club had to list six players for their rookie list. And those players, this is from an article in October 1996. Those players will be exempt from the salary cap and, importantly, will be able to play senior football. The clubs will be able to put those players on the rookie list through an intensive training program to try to bring them up to speed. So the rookie list has changed over the years.
Initially, it was for undrafted kids, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was for an under 18 player who might have been injured in his draft year, or a sandful or waffle or QAFL player who had been looked over and had 3 years in the system, and they could pick them up and go, oh, geez, we don't want to spend big money on you, but we'll have a crack. But then it changed over time, and there was various iterations of the rookie list, and sometimes the rookies weren't able to play unless there was a long-term injury. It's just... it is ridiculous, because it was last week that what day is it today? Wednesday. Today's Wednesday. So it was Tuesday the 24th of November, that the AFL let teams know that up to two players could just be transferred straight from their 2020 senior list to the rookie list. Because what used to happen is they would have to delist those players and then re-rookie them. So they've got rid of that pantomime, but it's ridiculous.
So what's the solution? Is it just saying, right, you've got a squad of 38 players, whoever, whatever it is after the COVID thing, you've got a squad of 38 players, do with that what you wish?
Correct.
And there's a long-term injury list. Actually, no, you don't even need that anymore. Don't even need that anymore.
Well, if teams don't have a reserves side, which most of them don't, and the ones that do have a reserve side, I'm pretty sure that they've got a bunch of top-up players. It's not like back in the 80s where you had to choose from your list of 72 players.
Yeah, there was
players.
An under-19s, there was a reserves, there was the seniors, yeah.
Exactly. So there's going to be no issues getting a group of 22 players from your list of 38. Your reserves might be completely made up of local players. Mm. But no, I remember way back in the day when it was called the supplementary list.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily mind that if there were parameters around it that said it was for people that haven't played the game before.
Must
people
be under 22, been, you know, under a certain number of games, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it's... Otherwise, you're getting Eddie Betts, Grant Birchall,
basically,
and Shane Mumford. Like, please,
probably almost 1,000 games between them.
And
they're classified as rookies for the point of Aussie rules football.
Five premierships, probably.
All right, let's move to the next one, and it's from Facebook. A message from Olivia King. So, thank you, Olivia.
Mm.
I'm paraphrasing a bit here, Andrew. Do you care if the Australian Open tennis moves dates?
No.
Me either, Olivia, but there seems to be a lot of fussing out there about a potential change to the Australian Open date moving.
Yes. Who is making the fussing?
Oh, it's hard to know because I think a lot of the Channel 9 wanted to play on the 18th, wanted to start on the 18th of January. Don't worry about that. Novak Djokovic wants it to play once
there
to
we
start
go.
Properly.
Now we're getting there.
But Channel 9 paid 300 mil for 6 years worth of Australian Open tennis in the month of January, where it's dead air and you completely own the airwaves. But the talk, and it's just talk at the moment, is that it may end up late February, early March. Worst case, March, April, which puts it on a collision course, as we say in the classics, with the two big leagues, the A-League as well, and a couple of other, the Formula One and major sporting events.
Formula One.
So, you know
what I've really liked about this is the complete and utter lack of any logic or reasoning behind any of the dates given and any of the reasons given. So,
Novak's actually made a decent point with why setting aside
questionable.
Now, I'm on the record everywhere saying tennis has not been a very good neighbour during the coronavirus COVID-19 pandemic. Whether it's Novak and his mates all partying down and all getting it, to them trying to push on with major tournaments and that in the face of huge public issues and problems, they don't care. They want to get their records and they want to make their money. So fair enough. Everyone has to make their money. But Novak's point of... players should be allowed to train or play in their second week of quarantine. I don't mind that altogether. I think that can work. We've seen it work in major sports. If every player is here at the same time and quarantining at the same time, where's the harm?
Well, it all comes down to the facilities of the place where they are staying. So you look at the let's go with AFL. They put the clubs in to resorts where they had golf courses so people could go out onto the course and they could, you know, run around or whatever it is that that AFL players do to keep fit. Then you look at the West Indies going, and Pakistan as well, going to England to play cricket. Now, there are two grounds in the UK that have a hotel on site. So they were able to be there and go and train without encountering the general public, nor walking in a spot where the general public would walk. Australia, I don't believe, has that. So that's the big reason, or one of the big issues, why they can't do that.
I think there's some close enough. Plus, everyone in every player and official, I think, at the Australian Open has their own driver and car provided.
There's a significant number. Actually, that I don't think it's every player. That's actually another reason why it might be a bad idea, because I used to work in East Melbourne, and when I was walking to work during the Australian Open time, you would see all of these Australian Open branded cars driving around because they would pick up a player from accommodation and drive them to the ground,
training,
and then they would come back the court.
Yes.
Then they would come back and pick someone else up. And so what they would need is, I imagine, their COVID safe plan would have to be one car per player. And it's just going to get so
That's
expensive. The one thing I don't understand, AJ, is why the Victorian government didn't agree to that, the original thing that the players wanted to come in December, do their 14 days quarantine, and then have a couple of weeks before the tournament. Now, that was going to coincide with what was, I think, called a festival of tennis or a tennis party, where all of the previous lead-up tournaments that would be held around Australia would all be held in Melbourne and Victoria.
Yeah, that's right, around regional Victoria. But the Victorian government haven't actually signed off on any tennis tournaments being played in the state yet.
Right.
As of Monday this week. So there's still a lot of organising that has to happen. I think that piece in the media about regional Victoria is going to host a plethora of, you know, the Brisbane International and the Canberra International and the Sydney International are all going to end up doing in Bendigo and Mildura and Traralgon and all of those places. Nothing had been signed. Nothing had been agreed. It was more a let's get behind this, everyone.
trying to build public momentum.
Yeah, for something that hasn't happened.
Mr. Simpson, your campaign has the weather of a runaway train. you said earlier that there are various thoughts about when the tournament might commence, and one of the ones I heard today was January 25th, which is a week after the original tournament. Mm. So they're basically going from anywhere from January 28th to April the 1st. You know, somewhere in there.
Easy. And it's look, I don't want to death ride anything, but I can't see those lead-in tournaments being played.
Oh, no.
Anyway, we've spent a lot of time talking tennis here. Let's move on. Next one.
All right. Can I have a question?
Yes. I was going to read one from the reader, but I'll do that next. What's yours?
Oh, okay. No. Go from the reader.
All right. Friend of the show, Dr. Alan Pierce, who we spoke to on Triple R a little while back, Andrew, tweeted us, will headers be taken out of football with the rise in dementia cases being reported in the UK? Now, this is an issue that has raised its head because Sport United Against Dementia in the UK from the Alzheimer's Society put out a report about the risks between heading a football, a soccer football that is, and research into dementia in players. What do you reckon?
Well, I, much like I imagine a lot of people, I have a significant number of things open on my phone and my internet. What do they call it? Various internet pages. I've got, I think when I open my phone, I've got 75 pages. If I roll back, 15 of the hottest hot sauce recipes, the Canberra Distillery Summer Gin, the 2,500-year-old history of adults blaming the younger generation, and FA guidelines, children to no longer head footballs during training.
That's right.
So this is from 24th of February, where there was children aged 11 and under will no longer be taught to head footballs during training in England, Scotland and Northern Ireland. AJ, I'm going to throw it back to you because I've played futsal where I was the goalkeeper, and I've played two and possibly three games of outdoor football, each of those with you, and you have probably played a significantly more games of football than me. What is it like heading a football?
It was interesting. Well, you don't really notice, to be honest. Futsal you do because the ball is deliberately heavier and you try not to head it. The point of it being heavier is that it stays on the ground. That's why heading the ball in futsal is incredibly rare. Heading the ball in indoor football, giant tennis ball, soccer is different as well. But on
is this where I tell you that as a goalkeeper, I in three seasons of futsal, I scored one goal and it was a header from a sideline pass from someone where I just ran down and it was the perfect pass.
Well, that explains why you've got so many tabs open in your phone now.
Does it hurt when you head a soccer ball?
It does not.
Outdoor soccer.
It does not.
Okay.
Take that ball in the face, in the side of the head, in the back of the head at pace, though. That's a different story. Heading it in the right spot is, well, feels fine, doesn't hurt at all. But one of the interesting things that when we posted about this a little while back on our Facebook page, one of the responses was, well, the balls are completely different now. They used to play with a giant leather sack, basically, and heavy boots on really heavy grounds. Plus the medical attention isn't the same. I would counter that now by saying the balls might be heaps lighter and made of a different fabric, but they are a bloody lot faster. They are coming, the precision and the passing and the speed of the ball is light years ahead of what it used to be. And obviously they're taking action in the UK, and I should have checked for the Australian syllabus to see if they have pulled the same thing here, but I'm not sure. I think to get to Alan's question, I think it's going to be out of it'll be taken out of training. I'm not sure it'll be taken out of football altogether.
Yeah, I read something the other day where it was something like they wanted to restrict people to 20 headers either per session or per week, and I can't remember which one it was. Now
that's weird to me. So all of a sudden, so 19, 20 headers is just right, 21 headers is too much, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
Well, now, correct me if I'm wrong, which I most likely am when I talk about soccer football, so I apologise, but the majority of headers would be taken in the forward half in an attacking mode, so either from a cross or from a corner coming in, and people, rather than just sort of letting the ball hit them, they are also meeting it with their head. So you've got the velocity of the ball and the velocity of the head coming together.
Yeah, but there's also most of the headers you would see are made by defenders who are either nodding a long ball away or hitting a cross out of bounds or trying to spoil a shot on goal. So there's a lot of different, you know, one-on-one jumps or group jumps to try and head the ball away, all that sort of stuff. There's a lot of head clashes when that happens as well.
Yeah, okay. Well, so what we've seen in a lot of sports over time, and when we actually talked to Alan Pearce, I don't even know how long ago was now, a couple of years ago now it would have been, and the thought of, you know, oh, it's just a minor concussion.
Mm.
Well, no, a concussion is a concussion is a concussion.
Yeah.
There's no such thing. I think there is something that he mentioned, like subconcussive incidents, but we talked about the use of helmets and how helmets have, I think it was zero effect on whether you get a concussion. It certainly stops the insides of your head coming
protects your ears, protects your hair.
But doesn't protect the brain.
Nicks over the eyes and that sort of thing, but you're going to get a concussion.
Is there a place for the soccer ball manufacturers? Every World Cup, they produce a new ball, don't they? They had the Jabulani.
With more swerve, more dip, more consistent feel for if you hit it. So when you're absolutely twatted, it won't go flying off into the car park.
Oh, I think technique comes into that as well, because mine often go into the car park. Now, is there a role for the ball manufacturer to play in this? Is there a potential for them to have a head-friendly ball, or is that...
Possibly, but how do you know? How do you know what's a... Anyway, who knows? Maybe. The technology's moving along. I don't know. Maybe one day.
Okay.
All right. Now, sorry, I interrupted you for that question. So off you go. We'll do your one, then one more from Twitter, and then we will wrap it up. What do you reckon?
Okay. I have a question for you, and it is around leagues and officials in leagues and how they should – what their relationship is like with the various clubs. And, you know, are they their stakeholders? Are they the servants to the clubs who are the masters? The Australian Baseball League, AJ, the Korea team, Geelong Korea, said, nah, we are out of the Australian Baseball League this season. And as expected, when the whole season was kind of set around various hubs and trying to get the different fixturing right so that teams would be in the right place at the right time, the league wasn't very happy. And Cam Vail, from the ABL, he kind of put out a really, really, I wouldn't even say pointed, I'd say angry media statement.
Was good
about it.
I loved it. Baseball Australia CEO Cam Vail was the guest on our previous podcast before we went on hiatus. So check that out in where you get your podcast, which has a lot of background on the plans that Baseball Australia had. Now, what happened, Andrew, was that earlier in the year, Geelong Korea had given a tip that it was unlikely they would be able to play. So plans were being made along, you know, with no real expectation that GK were going to make it. On the other hand, it's the Auckland Tuatara you're talking about.
Oh, sorry. My bad. I apologise, Geelong Korea.
The New Zealand team, who all the way along said, yes, we're in, yes, we're in, yes, we're in. And then the week the schedule was supposed to be released, they said, oh, no, we're out. And so hence the incredibly angry and forthright media release from Baseball Australia. I don't think I've ever seen one quite like that. We might post that on our Twitter and Facebook pages. It was really letting rip into how disappointed the league was and head office was with the Tuatara for pulling out when they did.
In the days following, Cam Vail said, we don't need to keep dwelling on it, but our statement yesterday had to be clear and it was deliberately harsh.
Mm.
So when I read it, I didn't think it was deliberately harsh. I thought it was whack, 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 whack.
Yes. Oh, it was an absolute plow job, wasn't it? They really just smashed him. Smack, smack, smack.
And as someone who has put so much time into trying to get various hubs, so they've got a hub in Brisbane, a hub in Adelaide, surely the chief executive has the right to say, oh, I'm going to town on you guys.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No problem with that. I've got no problem with that. To your question, it's a pretty different – it depends on the league, I guess. AFL, NRL, Super Netball, all of that, they're kind of part of the – they're part of the competition. They're not independently owned. In the Australian Baseball League, they are. Clubs are owned by individuals, like in the A-League as well. So
there's a little bit more okay.
– the license Baseball Australia owns holds the license or allocates the license, and one person owns that license. So the Tuatara are in strife, and there is talk that they had 28 days from that decision to justify how they weren't in breach of their license requirements. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. There's no way that they will be gone because they are absolutely massive asset for the Australian Baseball League. They got big crowds. They play in a great stadium. They have a TV deal, which not one of the other clubs and the league itself can boast. So it'd be absolute madness for them to get out, for them to be out.
Yeah, right.
This year anyway.
I just thought the statement was brilliant. I wish there was a lot more like it.
We will pass that.
I look at and like the most obvious one, because we live in Melbourne, the one that gets the most media attention is the AFL. And I watch some of those press conferences with the CEO or whatever it's called, Gil McLachlan, and you can just tell that he would love to say, oh,
you're a bunch of
these
clowns.
Idiots. But you can't. You can't do it. And similar in the cricket, in international cricket, it's really disappointing that Bangladesh weren't able to go over to Bangladesh and play. And Bangladesh,
as if we wanted to go there,
exactly, yeah. So, loved it, absolutely loved it. More of it.
All right, lovely. Now, one last question from the audience, and it's from Andrew McDougall on Twitter. And this is a good one, AFL-related one. Why is Paul...
At ASD_radio.
That's right. Why is Paul Roos considered to be a coaching messiah? Now, take a deep breath, and off you go. I've got some stats. I've got some stats, and when you want me to drop them in, just sing out.
I'm going to say, refer back to episode 7 of about
way
seven,
back
about
in 2016. Yeah.
Okay. Paul Ruse, he was really good for Sydney. He was an excellent coach in terms of determining the quality of the list, the strengths of the list, the ground that they played at the most of the time, and how to make the most of that. So well done. Kudos to you. And as he said, for all of you who have been waiting all these years, here it is.
One premiership in 2005 when he was also the All-Australian coach.
Yes, yes. But that was before he was seen as the messiah of the downtrodden teams. He was
the highly paid messiah of downtrodden teams. Oh,
yes, he was. Yes, that's right. Highly paid by the AFL. He was given to Melbourne, and he basically went, righto, well, you're not very good at attacking nor defending, so let's make you really good at defending. So they did that, but they then couldn't score. And that was a couple of seasons. Then he tried to implement the attacking side of things. It didn't quite work. Melbourne, they did okay, but never really reached the lofty heights that was expected of the messiah coach that was planted within their organisation. And then in recent times, was it North Melbourne when Reece Shaw unfortunately had to stand down as,
yep,
as
North
coach?
Melbourne. I think he's done it at another club as well, maybe Adelaide, but don't quote me on that.
Okay.
That may be wrong. But anyway, carry on. I'm in your way.
But of course, he was one of the very first names up out there because he's the best coach ever.
I'm glad you said that. Once. I'm gonna inject the stats here.
Okay.
Paul Ruse coached.
I'll let you know my vitriol towards the Paul Ruse as the messiah has waned over the years, and I don't have the script in front of me that I went with back in whatever it was. So fire
away. I've got a good
know.
One for you here. I'm going to do the stats, and then I'm going to do the win loss. Ratios of some of his contemporaries, and when I say the contemporaries' names, I want you to say if Paul Ruse is a better coach than him. Okay, you ready?
Fire away.
Paul Ruse, 268 games, 137 wins, 129 losses, 2 draws. So he has a 51.1% winning record. Some of his
that includes a terrible Melbourne side.
That's right. Right, his contemporaries. Now I've picked a few that he coached against and some that have come just after. Chris Scott has a 69% winning record with Geelong. Is he a better coach than Paul Ruse?
Oh,
yes or no? See, yes or no? We're running out of time. Yes or no is going to do it.
No.
Paul Ruse is better than Chris Scott. Okay.
Correct.
Adam
Paul
Simpson
Ruse is better than Chris Scott. But that says more about Chris Scott and the fact that
it's a yes or no. It's a yes or no answer, Andrew. Adam Simpson. Right. Adam Simpson from the West Coast Eagles has one premiership and a 64% winning record. Is he a better coach than Paul Ruse?
Yes.
Neil Craig, who coached Adelaide, had a 52% winning record. Is he better than Paul Ruse?
No.
Alistair Clarkson has 4 premierships and a 60% winning record. He is better. Yes.
Significantly better.
Mark Thompson had a 61% winning record, 2 premierships.
Better.
James Hurd had a 48% winning record as a head coach.
James Hurd was not very good.
Ross Lyon. Ross Lyon had a 57.
Oh, Ross Lyon's significantly better.
A 57% winning record. John Worsfold, who beat Paul Ruse for a premiership, had a 50.1% winning record. Which has been dragged down significantly by Essendon.
Well, so Ruse's was dragged down by...
It's yes or no, Andrew. John Worsfold or Paul Ruse?
Over the course of their career...
No, it's yes or no, Andrew. We're running out of time. Hurry up.
Draw.
Okay. Mark Williams has one premiership with Port Power.
Mark Williams.
A 55% winning record.
I love Mark Williams. Should have been the coach of GWS.
I'm interested in this one from you. This coach had a 51% winning record, same as Paul Roos. Didn't win a premiership, though. His name is Grant Thomas, who coached St Kilda.
Grant Thomas.
Is he a better coach than Paul Roos?
No.
All right. Well,
he's a funnier coach.
You've just rubbished Paul Roos for a good 5 minutes, and then said that he's a better coach than six of the 10 I've just given you, including four premiership coaches.
Hey, look, I never said I was consistent.
All right. Well, Andrew,
Grant Thomas, please. Grant Thomas appointed himself coach.
Yeah. And then one had the same win-loss record as Paul Roos.
Yeah.
Huh, how about that?
So I can't remember which ones I've said. But no, I'm comfortable with
it's too late. It's too late. We're moving on. We've hit our time mark. It's too late. We're moving on. Andrew, we're just about to go. But before we do, this isn't a question. I'm just going to tell you something that's happening this weekend.
Oh, okay. Tell me.
Mike Tyson is fighting Roy Jones Jr., a 54-year-old.
Oh, my God. He's ripped.
A 54-year-old fighting a 51-year-old. Probably the most pointless sporting exhibition. And Mike Tyson is ripped as Lord. Yes. Roy Jones Jr., one of the greatest boxers of all time, won titles in just about every weight division. I don't want to see this. And do you know what my favourite part of all
Roy
this
Jones
is?
Jr.,
I love Roy Jones Jr. I love Mike Tyson the fighter. I hate Mike Tyson the person, but that's another story. You'll like this. Before we switch our show off for the week, 54-year-old plus 50 fighting a 51-year-old. There's no ringside judges. It's 8 rounds of 2 minutes each. Hang on. 8 rounds of 2 minutes each.
There's so not no, 3 minutes.
There's no ringside judges. No winner will be announced. And this is my favorite part. They're not allowed to knock each other out.
So
why would you pay?
Excuse me, sir. I have a question.
Why would you pay any money at all to go and see that fight?
So a couple of things. You said earlier
you've got 25 seconds. So make it speedy.
All right. You said earlier it was the most pointless sporting event. I was going to say Conor McGregor against Floyd Mayweather until you said you can't knock the other person out. How can you determine that the velocity of your punch and the angle and where it hits on the person's face is going to knock the person out? Are they like Terminator? And you'll have those sort of like go...
That's why it's called the sweet science, Andrew. And don't forget, Roy Jones Jr. got knocked out by Danny Green, who brushed him on the top of the head. Remember that? Anyway.
Yeah.
This has been a sporting discussion. We're back from our hiatus. We're having a good time. Andrew, you still on Triple R, aren't you? Monday mornings? What's the go?
Monday morning, 7:15 a.m., talking sports of all sorts, as I always do. Yes, it's been a big couple of weeks talking about the WBBL. I have absolutely loved trying to get more cricket into my Triple R sports reports. It's been the best. Oh, Sophie Devine has just bowled a ripping in swinger to Mignon Dupriya. Sorry.
I thought she wasn't allowed to bowl. Anyway.
I thought that. That is the first ball that she's bowled this in the last four matches. One for none off one.
102.7 FM in Melbourne or RRR.com.au. You can hear me on ABC Central Victoria, 91.1 FM in Victoria or on the ABC Listen app. Don't forget to go out to our funky website at sportingdiscussion.com.au. You can tweet us at ASD_radio. Facebook us at facebook.com/thesportingdiscussion. Join the group, a sporting discussion forum. Good fun in there. Lots of stuff going around. Good people posting their own stuff, which is what it was all about when we set that up.
Yes.
We don't want to be doing everything.
And also, so like, just good, respectful discussion.
Discussion, not banter. That's my tattoo.
Yeah, it's just bants, mate. It's just bants.
On my now hefty tummy, Andrew, I'm going to get discussion, not banter, tattooed in three different colours. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week. Hope you enjoyed that. Speak soon.